It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.
Hi again, everyone, and welcome to the Open Concessions Podcast presented by Toyota, featuring a weekly in-depth conversation with a Chicago Cubs-related personality. And sometimes we veer a little bit. We are your hosts. I'm Len Casper alongside Jim Deshaies. We make up the Cubs television tandem, and we've got a fun one today, JD. Dan Epstein and Brad Baluchian. We're going to take a little trip down memory lane and talk about, I guess, our favorite baseball decades, right? The 70s for you as a kid, and for me, the 80s.
Yeah, right in my wheelhouse as a fan, the 70s baseball is what I grew up watching. I remember, you know, the All-Star games were must-see. I would sit and watch games on television with a scorebook. As a young guy. And then, of course, the 86, those are all my contemporaries. That was my first full year in the big league. So two very interesting guys and very interesting approaches to their books.
Dan Epstein is an award-winning journalist, pop culture, history guy, avid baseball fan. He has written Big Hair and Plastic Grass, A Funky Ride Through Baseball and America in the Swinging 70s, and Stars and Strikes, Baseball and America in the Bicentennial Summer of 76. Brad Baluchian is the director of Merritt College's new Natural History and Sustainability program. Like Dan, has written for Rolling Stone, among other publications. And his new book is called The Wax Pack, the story of Brad tracking down all the players in a single pack of Topps baseball cards from 1986, including our buddy Rick Sutcliffe. And the one thing I'll say before we start, JD, is Dan and Brad, they're not the same age. Dan's a little older. He's more your era. Brad is younger, but they kind of come at it from a similar perspective.
Yeah. And they seem to be kindred spirits. And, you've read the books. I have not. I've been able to preview them a little bit. So they're at the top of my shopping list now.
Absolutely. Here we go. Let's enjoy Dan Epstein and Brad Baluchian. Dan and Brad, it's great to have both of you with us. Dan, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Doing fine. Missing baseball, but it's coming back sooner than later, which is good. Brad, thanks for joining us. How are you?
Thanks for having me, Len. I'm doing well.
Well, I am a big fan of both of you, and I've read one book each. I have Stars and Strikes, which Dan sent to me, and we'll get into 1976 a little later and why you chose that particular year in baseball history. But I guess, Dan, the big question for you would be, what is it about 1970s baseball that grabbed your heart? Was it simply that's the time when you were young and baseball did grab your heart?
Well, that's part of it, certainly. I mean, I was 10 years old in 1976, so, that was the era I came up as a fan. But I think some of it also had to do with probably in the late 90s, around the time of the Sosa McGuire home run chase, I started thinking a lot about how different baseball had become from the era that I'd grown up in, and realized, you know, as I started looking for books on the era of the 70s, just because I wanted to understand it more, I realized that there hadn't been much coverage of it. And the historical coverage of the era had tended to view it as this kind of weird, sort of bump, kind of anomaly that was probably best not looked at too closely, because, you know, it was filled with, you know, things like rebellion and drugs and fan riots and all of that. And I really just felt like, you know, that there's more, you know, that there's, it was an incredibly rich decade culturally as well as in terms of baseball, and that the game really needed to be looked at, the game of the 70s really needed to be looked at through a kind of pop cultural lens.
And Brad, we'll certainly dive into your literal and figurative journey during the Wax Pack, but there are a lot of players, most of them in your 1986 Topps pack, whose careers began in the 1970s. So it really meshes the two authors together really well.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, one of the things about the players in the Wax Pack is I think all of them played about at least 10 years aside from Jaime Coconauer. So a lot of these guys, their careers began in the late 60s, early 70s.
So your journey, I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but we kind of gave the synopsis of the book. I love the idea. What was your big goal when you set out on this journey to talk to all of these players and ex-players, I should say, and all the detours you took ended up probably making the book much better than you thought it would be, right?
Yeah, I know. It's you know, one of the great things about projects like these is that you don't really know what you're going to get going in, which actually makes it really hard to sell a book because, you know, the gatekeepers in the publishing industry are so risk averse that they want you to tell them up front exactly what's going to happen and what it's about and what you're going to find. And, you know, I would say, well, look, I mean, my goal is to find all these guys, to do a kind of where are they now, to find out what happens after they're done playing. But until I get on the road, I'm not going to know all the themes that come out. And, you know, sure enough, the best themes in the book were things that I didn't anticipate, like the father-son relationship and things like that. So, but I do think it's better for the chase, you know, for not necessarily having all the guys be cooperative and helpful. It adds a lot of narrative tension and conflict. And, you know, every good story needs to have that ebb and flow emotionally and narratively. And so by having some guys not want to talk to me, that actually makes it a stronger book.
I've got a two for you, Brad. One, am I correct that I read that you were rejected 37 times, something
38,
like that? 38 times. Yeah, that's good for you, man. Bully for you for the perseverance. And two, this is a coming clean moment. Did you open a pack and go, oh, these guys are boring, I'm going to open up another pack and that's going to be my story?
Whenever I got Jim Deshaies, I was like, put that back. We need another pack.
Yeah, we need to move on.
No, I there is a footnote in the book where I say that I did open several packs because if I just open, I mean, I would have loved to just open one and that would be the one and only. But, you know, what if I got five guys that were dead or, you know, everyone in Indiana or something? So, I did end up picking a pack that had all but one player that was still alive and that they were spread out around the country.
Dan, in Big Hair and Plastic Grass, I mean, the title says it all, but going back to your opening remark about the culture in the 1970s, it hit baseball in a big way. I mean, if you just turn on a game from 1974 and you look at the uniforms and the hairstyles alone, it really does say a lot about that decade culturally in general, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think if you compare that game from 1974 to a game from, you know, just 5 years earlier, 1969, you would see so much difference, you know, in terms of the uniforms, in terms of the way the players wear their hair, in terms of, you know, the surface on the playing field, in terms of, you know, if you're watching an American League game, there's a designated hitter now. If you're, you know, and so much of the way the players comported themselves on the field changed in just a few years. I mean, there was, as I say in Big Hair and Plastic Grass, I mean, this was a time where players finally felt comfortable with letting their freak flags fly, and I think so much of that was related to what else was happening in America at the time.
You write a lot about Disco Demolition in 1979. And the one thing I really appreciated about your analysis of what happened at Comiskey Park is that it was nuanced. And Steve Dahl is a friend of mine, so full disclosure there. But it, at the time, was treated as though it had some racial undertones and overtones. And essentially, Steve was just like, no, it was just kind of a gimmick.
Yeah, and I think it still is, perhaps even more so viewed through that that lens today. And I think there were certainly elements of that, not in Steve's intention, perhaps, but in, you know, the people that an event like that would attract, and certainly in the feeling, you know, the anti-disco sentiment at the time. A lot of it in America was sort of, well, this is, you know, this is black music and it's supplanting rock and roll, which, you know, of course, is based on black music, but people weren't thinking in those terms. And but I think there was an element of that, you know, disco had completely saturated popular culture at that point. You look at any JCPenney ads from the summer of 79 and there's disco fashions and there's disco toys and there's, you know, disco everything. And even as somebody who was a disco fan in the summer of 79, I remember thinking, like, you know, geez, does every song have to be about dancing? Can we mix this up a little here?
Maybe one about roller skating?
Exactly. Right. I think there were two different roller disco movies in the summer of 79. There were a lot of different elements feeding into it. And then, of course, there was the, like, wow, you know, certainly as a 13-year-old boy in the summer of 79, like, you know, what excited me more than things being blown up and people running out onto a baseball field and, you know, throwing clumps of dirt around? Like, I thought that was cool. And so did a lot of other people. And obviously, you know, there were some pretty uncool elements to it all as well. But, you know, I don't think it serves the event or history well to just say, well, this was this, and this is, you know, this one reason was why this all happened.
And to kind of tie the two stories together, Brad, in terms of race and baseball, several guys you talked to that came up, in particular, the story of Gary Templeton.
Yeah. As I was saying earlier, not knowing the themes that were going to come out in the book, I didn't realize what a role race would play in the book. And getting to Templeton, he was probably the most unexpected surprise, or the biggest surprise in terms of kind of what I expected him to be like versus what he was like. Because in reading the media coverage from the Times, his era, you know, I thought he might be more aloof, but he was super engaging and super outgoing and friendly, and to the point where I went over to his house and we were watching kung fu movies and, you know, talking to his wife and meeting his family and, you know, going out to eat and all this. But as part of that, I mean, I guess the main focus of that chapter is his side of the story from the Whitey Herzog incident in 1981 that came to, unfortunately, define a lot of his career. And when you read the whole story behind that, you really realize the context of those times and how hard it was to be a black player back in the 70s and 80s, how much racism still played a big role in the game. And so I was glad to be the messenger for that.
And as I look at, you know, the rest of your group, it's a really fascinating group of guys. Again, I don't want to give away the ending to the story, but there's a Hall of Famer in there involved who you spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to get to. And you use some unconventional and unorthodox ways and means to try to talk to some of these players, including taking a tour of the ballpark in Houston. And I don't know if you ended up buying a house on a golf course in Florida, but that was your disguise, so to speak, to try to get to Carlton Fisk.
Yeah. I was a few million short of being able to do that. But and you know, feel free to I mean, there's no spoilers to me in terms of talking about Carlton Fisk or what happens in the book or the different people. But I really looked at the way that I was trained in journalism was in the sort of the new journalism tradition from the 60s and the call it literary nonfiction, where people like Tom Wolfe and Gay Talese doing this years ago, where you're, as the writer, you're an active participant in the story. And so that's what I do in the Wax Pack. And when certain guys like Carlton Fisk or Gary Pettis, you know, weren't able or willing to talk to me, I then decided to make that part of the story. And I write about those, you know, all the different extremes that I went to try to get to them, and from the first person perspective and sort of what it was like to be in my shoes. And it's a technique or a style that's not done that much anymore, but I really, you know, it's the technique that I always wanted to do. But I'm curious, like, since we have Jim Deshaies here, if you were one of the players in the pack, how do you think you would have responded to me cold calling you and saying, "Hey, I want to meet up with you. You're one of the players in this pack."
Yeah, I would have been intrigued for sure, and I would have. I'm sure I would have made time to sit down and chat. And that was my question for you. Those that didn't, what reasons did they give? Did they not trust that you were a legit journalist, or just didn't want to make the time? What was the excuse?
Well, it varied. So with Gary Pettis, that's what Len was just talking about when I went to the ballpark tour in Houston. You know, he's the third base coach for the Astros. And he was the only guy that was still in Major League Baseball. And so I knew I'd have to kind of go through official channels once I struck out trying to go directly to him. And so the Astros PR people basically said, well, AJ Hinch has said that he's not allowing any of the coaches to talk to the media this year. Wow. And so he just said, you know, it's off the table. Someone like Carlton Fisk, just through his agent, he was one of the few players that still has people to go through. And so his people said, no, he's just not interested, without really offering an explanation. So, you know, the reasons varied depending on the guy.
Dan, in terms of the decade of the 70s, you could argue Fisk's home run in the 75 World Series was kind of the best baseball moment. Oscar Gamble's hair, maybe a second. What would you say was the best baseball moment of that decade?
I mean, for me, it's Hank Aaron breaking Babe Ruth's home run.
There you go. Yep.
I think that's that. And, you know, and unfortunately, and I think, you know, and this is one of the reasons I wrote Big Hair and Plastic Grass, was because I felt that generally the 70s had been distilled down to Hank Aaron's record-breaking home run, Carlton Fisk's Game 6 home run in 75, you know, and maybe Pete Rose's hitting streak in 78. And that, you know, then that was kind of, let's move on here. but really, I mean, I think... certainly, you know, on so many levels, that's such a resonant moment. Hank Aaron, you know, hitting 715, and for me, you know, as a young baseball fan, like I didn't really 74 was a little bit before I really got into baseball, but I just remember the excitement around that. I remember, you know, watching the highlights on TV and just like, you know, knowing that I was living through history, and that was so exciting. And I mean, even before I got into baseball, I was a big fan of history, American history. And so that just, you know, was, I mean, to my not even 8-year-old brain, that was just a moment of like, wow, like I got to be alive to see this. And this is so cool. And, you know, what is it, 46 years later, I still think it's incredibly cool that we got to witness that.
Yeah, I have, when Hank was getting close, you know, we tried to pay attention as much as we could. So just for context, I was 14 in 1974.
Sure.
And we had a little cassette player that we put next to the television with a microphone on so we could record the broadcast of the game. And I think it's either 714, 715. I'm pretty sure it was 15. Over Kirk Gowdy. We had Kirk Gowdy on the call on television. I think the call everybody hears now is Milo Hamilton's. There's a new home run champion, blah, blah, blah. But that was like, yeah, as a kid, you're like locked in and you're recording this and you're keeping scorebooks. And I mean, it's you're in that sweet spot, you know, probably from the age of, I don't know, 9 to 14 before, you know, what you start to think about girls or, you know, get closer to driving cars. But I mean, you're locked in, right?
Absolutely. And for me, it was also like between 10 and 14 that I was really, you know, that was before I really got into music. That was before I really, you know, write girls, obviously, got kind of pulled away from the game. But yeah, I mean, I was living and breathing every broadcast I could experience, every box score I could get my hands on. I mean, I was just, you know, in full on absorption mode between 1976 and 1980. So for Big Hair and Plastic Grass, that, you know, writing that book was a lot of, you know, me channeling the enthusiasm I felt for the game in those years. And then going back to the first part of the decade and seeing, okay, how did these years inform what I experienced from 76 to 1980?
Doc Ellis and Mark Fidrich, two of the great characters in baseball history and very much a part of that decade in both of your books.
Yes, and really because 76 is the, you know, that's the year of the bird. And so obviously he's a major character in Stars and Strikes, as well as one of the cover boys for Big Hair and Plastic Grass. And Doc Ellis, obviously he's kind of gone down in history as the guy who threw the no-hitter under the influence of LSD. But there's really a lot more to him and his story than that. And 76 is the year that he's traded to the Yankees and actually helps them win their first pennant since 1964. And also has a showdown with Reggie Jackson, who's doing his sabbatical in Baltimore that year. So it was fun for me to be able to kind of show that that chapter of Doc's life in Stars and Strikes.
We have more threads here, and I'll start with Dan and we'll go to Brad. How important, Dan, was it for the Yankees and the Dodgers to kind of reassert themselves as two of the best in baseball in the late 1970s? Because you had the A's, you had the Reds, you had the Pirates, the Orioles. Those were kind of the dominant teams in the first half of that decade.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that we were thinking so much in terms of, you know, big market versus small market teams back then. But I mean, it just as a fan, and I was a bit of a Dodger fan back then because my mom was living in Los Angeles. But it was, again, just as a fan with some sense of baseball history, it's like, wow, how cool. It's Dodgers versus Yankees again. Just like when my dad, you know, my dad grew up as a Brooklyn Dodgers fan. So this was just like, you know, to me, this was the rivalry, you know, all over again, even though Dodgers were now in Los Angeles. And both of those teams were very different, both filled with very interesting characters, both, you know, played very different kinds of baseball. And I mean, the 77 and 78 World Series were so exciting and so gripping. And I have to feel like that pulled a lot of people back to the game who may have, been on the sidelines for a while there.
And Brad, one of your subjects, Steve Yeager, and I don't know if there was trepidation, but you had read and heard about kind of a bigger than life personality that he was and really still is to this day. And I found that chapter to be absolutely terrific.
Thanks. Yeah. Yeager, in the research that I did on him, you know, he comes across as this, confident, outgoing, kind of boisterous guy. And I found him to be that way. But I think what the really nice thing about that chapter is the unexpected part, which is where he really talks about a lot of personal things about how his father was such an alcoholic that when he went to watch him play in Cincinnati, he passed out in the clubhouse. And so he never really wanted to, you know, have his dad come to games again. And how when he was unsigned as a free agent in 1987 during the whole collusion scandal, how he couldn't even turn the TV on to watch baseball. He said it hurt so much. And he dumped out every drop of alcohol in his house in 1987, the first year he was retired, and never drank again. You know, these things are, the fact that he was willing to open up and be vulnerable and share those really personal things, I think that's really kind of the heart of my book, is with a lot of these guys, is their ability, the courage it takes for them to open up and share those things. And, you know, to me, that's what makes my interest in these players to begin with, was their heroism. But that was their heroism on the baseball field, and, you know, these larger than life people or figures. What makes them heroic in the wax pack is nothing to do with baseball, but who they are as people and their willingness to deal with their own demons and their fear and to be vulnerable.
Yeah, JD, you can chime in here. We have a lot of friends, and you have former teammates who were bigger than life, who have, let's be honest, enormous egos, but they're also incredibly generous and kind and fun. But in a lot of ways, you cannot have an industry like this where the best in the world, who make a ton of money and have all the fame in the world, it comes with the territory, right? You're not going to have, 300 of the humblest human beings in baseball at any given time. That's just not how it works.
No, and I think a lot of guys, it's that confidence that drives them, that gets them to the highest level. And I also think the game changes people. My recollection when I got done playing, I remember reflecting at some point after I retired and thinking, well, that was weird. Like, you're this one person up until that point. Then you enter this industry that's very unique and different, and a lot that comes with it. And you go for this merry ride, and it's crazy and it's wonderful and heartbreaking at times. And then you get done, and then you revert back to, for me, it's a small town knucklehead from Northern New York. And it's just another great example is years ago when I was broadcasting in Houston, we had Jeff Kent on after, his playing days were done, and they were doing a bobblehead celebrating Kent. And the whole time he was with us down in Houston as a player when I was broadcasting, I mean, he was just miserable and ornery, and you couldn't get two words out of him. And it was just, oh, my goodness. And so Bill Brown and my partner and I, we joked in anticipation of Kent's appearance. Oh, this guy's not going to say a word to us. And he got on the air, and he was the best guest we ever had. I mean, he was yucking it up. He was funny. He was engaging. And I just looked at him. I go, dude, who are you? Where did this come from? He just, my wife used to give me a hard time all the time, said you got to be nicer to people. But I needed to be that way to compete every day. And not everybody has to do that, but some guys do. So we get this perception of them as being ornery or aloof or whatever, and they're just playing a role in many ways. They're just protecting themselves from the outside.
Yeah, and I think, Brad, that's why the guys who are farthest removed from the game were probably the easiest to wrangle. And the guys who are still kind of close to the game, not so much, because you do get in that bubble and you tend to tune everything out. Did you find that to be the case in general? The guys who are kind of more comfortable with their life, those were the easy peasy guys?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question about identity, right? I make this point towards the end of the book that most ball players, unlike the rest of us, have two lives, kind of what Jim was just saying. There's your baseball life, which ends around age 35. And then there's, okay, now the rest of my life. For most of the guys that were not big stars, it's a little bit easier because they can fade back into the general population. Now, if you're Carlton Fisk or Dwight Gooden or Vince Coleman, just to mention three of the guys in my book that were really hard to get to talk or to work with. I think part of that challenge is because they've continued on in their identity as the baseball player Carlton Fisk, right? And they haven't had the opportunity to shed that identity. I think it's possible, but I think when you reach that level of fame and success and money, there's a very addictive quality to that, you know, and it's a lot harder to let go of that if you know that as Dwight Gooden, you can continue to sign your autograph and make $100 30 years after you're done playing. You know, it's tempting to do that, even if it may actually not be in your own best interest to continue in that identity.
Great stuff with Brad Baloukchian and Dan Epstein. We will continue after a quick word from our sponsor. Here's to the road ahead. Trust Toyota to be here for you. A Toyota hybrid will give you the confidence to go farther than ever. Enjoy advanced tech in the Camry hybrid. Load up the family in the roomy Highlander hybrid or adventure in the RAV4 hybrid, the best hybrid SUV for the money. Right now, get 0% financing on every Toyota hybrid. All from the brand you trust. Today, tomorrow, Toyota. View U.S. News best cars at cars.usnews.com on 2020 hybrid models. Terms available on approved credit through participating dealers and Toyota Financial Services. Not all customers will qualify. Void where prohibited. Offer ends July 6th, 2020. Dan, we mentioned the Yankees. George Steinbrenner is prominent in Big Hair and Plastic Grass, as is Reggie Jackson, who actually did have a big league career before he became a Yankee, but it got a lot more interesting when he hit New York.
It really did. I mean, I feel like Reggie is the quintessential player of the 1970s. I think he is, such a charismatic character in and of itself, but also he is kind of emblematic of you know, something you saw in the 70s more than you'd seen before, which is the black superstar who is, you know, confident in his own views and, you know, will, you know, say whatever he wants to the press and doesn't feel like he has to toe any kind of line in terms of self-expression. And also, I mean, this was a guy who, with the game on the line, you wanted him at the plate, whether, you know, it was during his years with the Oakland A's mustache gang, or whether it was, you know, in the World Series with the Yankees in 77 and 78. I mean, this is a guy who he won 5 World Series rings in the 70s. The first one, 72, he was actually out of action with a hamstring injury. But, you know, because of what he'd done during the season in 72, that was a big part of why the A's made it that far to the World Series. And this is a guy who, you know, he was on, let's see, 5 division winners with the A's. Two division winning teams in the 70s with the Yankees. I mean, he was always right there in the thick of it. Of course, with Reggie, you also got controversy, and you got him locking horns with Charlie Finley, the owner of the Oakland A's, and with George Steinbrenner. You had him locking horns with Thurman Munson of the Yankees, with several of his teammates on the A's and the Yankees. And, you know, that there was just always, he was always making headlines one way or another.
I have to be honest, and one great thing about Big Hair and Plastic Grass is YouTube, because I found myself getting halfway through a story and I would have to go find the incident on YouTube. And JD, I'm sure you've seen this a million times too. And Brad, if you have, you can say, I didn't feel like he loafed on that base hit to right. After which he and Billy Martin really had it out in the dugout at Fenway Park. Reggie seemed to have a pretty good explanation of why he kind of laid back on the ball. So it tells me that there was a lot under the surface there, that it wasn't just about that play. Is that fair to say, Dan?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, and some of it wasn't really even Reggie that Billy had a problem with. Billy was also engaged in, you know, constant war with George Steinbrenner and really resented the fact that Steinbrenner wouldn't listen to Billy when it came to, you know, players that Billy thought should be added to the Yankees. Billy didn't want Reggie on the Yankees in 77, but it wasn't just because he didn't like Reggie. It was because he really wanted Joe Rudy. He felt that the Yankees, the 76 Yankees had a really good chemistry, filled with players, you know, who were really kind of hard-nosed and played the Billy way. But they just didn't quite have enough bats or arms. So Steinbrenner in the offseason went and signed Don Gullett to add to the pitching staff, and he signed Reggie over Billy's objections. So it was, and this was, you see this with other players like Kenny Holtzman, who came to the Yankees in this trade during the 76 season with Baltimore. It was like a massive 15 player trade. And Billy felt like, you know, he hadn't asked for Kenny Holtzman. He resented George making that trade without his input. And so he was just going to sit Holtzman on the bench as much as possible. And, you know, this is obviously not a great way to manage a ball team, but this was, you know, so I mean, obviously there was a lot of bad feeling between Reggie and Billy, but a lot of it had its roots in, you know, Billy feeling like he was getting, he was not allowed to have the control over the way the team was built that he wanted.
Your career as a big leaguer, JD, you're connected to the Astros. That's where you spent most of your time and had your most success. But I know you and I have talked a lot about your Yankee upbringing, playing with John Elway, playing for Yogi and Billy briefly. I know it's cool for you, right, to kind of have been a part of that circus kind of near the end of it. But some of the cool stories you've told about how Billy dealt with all the craziness in New York.
Yeah, it was just, coming up through that system and you hear all the stories and then you get there. And my time in New York was very, very brief. I got just a glimpse of it. I had a couple starts in 84 and then a call up in 85 and ultimately got traded in September of 85. But the ship was starting to kind of wobble a little bit with Billy in 85 when I was there. And I've told you the story a number of times when I got called up. He didn't even admit that I was there. You know, guys, normally when you get called up, the manager would call you into his office and welcome you. And, you know, here's how I'm going to use you or not use you, or, you know, whatever it is. Joe Maddon would call a guy in and say, just try not to suck, try to get him to relax. But Billy didn't acknowledge my presence. So I wasn't even listed on in the bullpen guys, the extra guys when the game started my first day in the big leagues, or the year, 85 when Billy was managing. And, so I had to tell Gene Michael, say, hey, Stick, I'm not even on the card. And you know, he scribbled my name on there. So there's no chance I was going to be used. And I did not know Billy was aware of my presence until about 3 or 4 days later when one of the writers asked him about a potential Subway Series with the Yankees and the Mets because they were both having really good years. And Billy said something to the effect of, are you kidding me? So the Mets got Gooden. And all I got was Deshaies and Armstrong. Mike Armstrong had been called up from AAA as well at the same time. So it was like this brief moment where, like, all right, Billy knows I'm here.
That's so good.
It was a different time.
And Brad, you know, again, you talked to so many interesting guys and guys who had great big league careers, guys who had short careers. Probably the common thread is when they were, you know, 14 and 15, they were all the best player in the city and in the state in which they played. But do you think that the identity of some of these guys is kind of stuck in what happened once they got to the big league level? You know, Jaime Coconauer, Randy Reddy, you know, guys who had big league careers but didn't have the 17-year, you know, close to Hall of Fame type career. Did you sense any regrets from guys like those, or was it more that they were just proud that they got there?
No, I didn't sense any regret. In fact, I would say that the one anomaly in the pack is Coconauer, who had the shortest career, you know, just 4 years with the Brewers and not a lot of success. And he was very open about saying that he never quite felt like he fit in. He didn't feel like, or he knew that he wasn't cut from the same cloth as a lot of his teammates, and that was probably what was holding him back. And that he had the incredible physical talent, but he would talk about how he was amazed at how these other guys could, you know, strike out 4 times or get their head bashed in on the mound, and then immediately kind of let it go and forget about it. And that he was unable to do that, you know, that he had a really hard time, you know, just kind of being in the present moment and forgetting about what just happened. And so, but, you know, so even though Kokenauer struggled the most out of all the guys in the pack, he's probably the most well-adjusted guy in life in that. Of all the guys that I met, I mean, he had a college degree when, you know, the day he stepped off the mound, went right into a really nice white collar job at an accounting firm, now has this beautiful house on a lake in Arkansas, and seems like the happiest, really. So, you know, you can say what you want about the importance of success in baseball, you know, even for guys that play a long time, baseball is just a small fraction of their life. And so I would say that, you know, Kokenauer, it's kind of that tortoise and the hare idea about when you look at the whole picture.
And you were a particular fan of Don Carmen, correct?
Did you know him, Jim?
Yeah, I knew Don a little bit.
Yeah, he was my favorite as a kid. I mean, I was a weird kid in that my favorite players were not the stars. You know, I had a whole collection of Don Carmen cards, and I wrote him a birthday card as a kid, trying to get his autograph. And you know, I remember going to this. You know, you go to like a collector show, and they would have all these plaques made of all the star players, and I would say, why? I want a plaque that says Don Carmen, and so I would have like a custom made plaque made that had Don Carmen's nameplate. And then he ends up, you know, he's one of the players in the pack. And so that, you know, to me, that's really
serendipity.
Yeah, well, also kind of the highlight of the book in that who he turns out to be, which I had no idea what kind of guy he was going to be. But such an exceptional guy in all ways. And I was just stunned at how much I ended up having in common with him as I got to know him. And again, just like I was saying with Jaeger, even more so, Carmen, I mean, within an hour of meeting him at the zoo in Naples, Florida, he's telling me about his father being abusive and, you know, these really deep, you know, really personal things. And it was surreal to be sitting across from your childhood hero, having him, you know, tear up and get emotional in front of me.
And he was a very funny guy, what I recall, when he played. He was very quippy, great with the one-liner.
I mean, because he's a guy that he sees everything a little bit differently. And he's just kind of has that kind of maverick or kind of iconoclastic view of things. And so a very good sense of humor. That's you know, was a big part of his persona.
I assume, Dan and Brad, you've both read Ball 4. It's been a long time since I have, and I probably should reread it once a year. Jim Boughton's really groundbreaking book, essentially chronicling the 69 season in Seattle before the Pilots moved to Milwaukee. How important, Dan, was that particular book? And I do think it is interesting that it was written at the dawn of that decade, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think that book could have been published even 5 years earlier. I mean, Jim Brosnan wrote a couple of interesting similar books in the early 60s about, you know, life as a pitcher in the big leagues. But it's, you know, a lot of the racier, grittier, less you know, family-friendly things were certainly left aside. But also, you know, I think Boughton's book really, aside from kind of showing that ball players are, you know, not necessarily the kind of faultless all-American idols that they were presented to be, I think what was really interesting and ultimately very important about Boughton's book was that it showed how, you know, the disparity between the salaries that the stars were making and that all the other guys were making and the way that, you know, they kind of went from year to year, you know, one season contract to one season contract. That, you know, was not, I mean, that really plays into what we wind up seeing with the, you know, with a strike in 72 and the lockout in 76 and the ultimate, you know, full-scale free agency that we see for the first time at the end of 76. Like, this is all sort of, you know, stirring the pot that would result in much more equitable pieces of the pie for major league ball players.
So, Len, two things, if I might.
I've been
reading a great book called Boughton that just came out by Mitch Nathanson, which is a biography of Boughton. And I think it reads as a great prequel to Dan's book, Stars and Strikes, because it kind of sets the stage for all the themes that Dan was talking about. And secondly, I wanted to say thank you to Dan. You know, Dan, we've corresponded and we never actually have talked or met in person. But when I was first starting the plan for Wax Pack, it was books like Dan's that gave me the faith that I could actually get it published. Because,
oh, that's great.
You know, when I read your book, and I remember reading the acknowledgments and like, oh, who was Dan's agent and who was the editor? And like, it was sort of like a proof of concept that books about these guys in this era could get published. And so, you kind of blazed the trail for me. So thank you.
Oh, well, my pleasure. And I have to say that, well, I didn't rack up quite as many rejections as you for Big Hair and Plastic Grass. There was a lot of like, wow, the 70s were a long time ago. Who's going to want to read this book? And, you know, just things that would like have me pounding my head against my desk, like, oh, the 70s, that's when Don Mattingly played, right? Like, no. So I completely applaud your persistence, and I completely feel the pain of what you went through, because yeah, it can be a really soul crushing experience to try to get a baseball book published that's a little bit or even a lot outside the box.
With the success of Stars and Strikes, Dan, did you get were people suggesting you do a book on the 80s?
Oh, yes. Well, with both Big Hair and Plastic Grass and Stars and Strikes, there was like, when are you going to do one for the 80s? I still get that probably about once a week. And the sad fact of the matter is, and I tell this to anyone who wants to write a baseball book or a book on anything, really, it's like you have to write about what you love.
That's right.
It's so time consuming, both in the research, the writing, and, you know, the promotion. That like you better love this with every fiber of your being,
right.
And the sad fact of the matter is I don't love 80s baseball. It doesn't even interest me. So the idea, and I don't really love the 80s and what the 80s were in America, which is a big part of how I view the game. So like to go back and write about this period in the game, I would have to write about this period of America and American culture and American music. And, you know, I just don't want to wade into that pool.
Yeah. You don't want to write about Wang Chung for 5,000 words, but.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm glad you said that, because I get asked in almost every interview, am I going to do a sequel? And for the same reason, and people may be disappointed, but like I had the same reason, which is like, I would not have the same passion and love trying to do a pack of 87 tops, because you know the idea has been done, the novelty is gone, and it's not something that I would have my whole heart into. So sure. I totally get that.
When you tore into these packs from 1986 to Jeep, the gum.
Yeah, that was actually, I wrote about that, and you know, in exquisite detail about how painful that was. But I felt like it was a rite of passage, you know. And then actually what was kind of cool was the book opens and closes with the people. I actually tracked down the employees who literally made and manufactured the gum and the cards in 1985 at the factory in Tops, for Tops. And I was able to kind of get them to walk me through the whole process of how they made the gum and how they made the cards.
Wow.
And it's really cool when you hear that backstory.
I can see when the movie's being made, you're chewing the gum, and then the grainy picture and the flashback, and then we go back to 1986 and it starts all over.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And by the way, if you want to dive into Big League Chew, that would be another good thing to do from that era. Rob Nelson, you guys know that name? He, and I believe Jim Boughton, right? Kind of teamed up to create Big League Chew when they were in Portland. And if people listening have not seen The Battered Bastards of Baseball. It's about a 75-minute Netflix documentary. It's absolutely terrific and kind of sums up 70s baseball, even though it's at the low minor league level. Independent ball, the whole deal. It's great. Brad, we'd be remiss if before we finished our conversation, I didn't put you on the spot a little bit, since you put a lot of former players on the spot. And you wrote about this stuff pretty explicitly in the book. I have had bouts of OCD, probably not clinically so, but I've dealt with a very similar issue that you talked about. How are you doing with it? And how did that affect positively or negatively your journey?
Yeah, well, the you know, as people ask me, like, oh, are you, you know, did you cure your OCD? Are you over it? And I say, well, as long as my head is attached to my shoulders, I will always have OCD. It's not, you know, you don't, it's not mm-hmm. something you get rid of. It's a condition like diabetes that you manage. But I would say that I have the tools and the toolbox to know how to manage it so that it's not disruptive in my life. And I wanted to include that in the book, number one, to raise awareness, excuse me, around what OCD actually is, because, you know, it's often just portrayed in this comedic way on TV with, you know, checking locks and washing your hands and stuff. And it's really just an anxiety disorder that has to do with, you know, how people with OCD respond to irrational thoughts and the compulsions and rituals they get into. And I thought there was also this interesting parallel between, OCD being an anxiety disorder is just about fear. You know, how do you manage fear? And that is a theme that all baseball players have to deal with at a very high level, because it's a game where there's more failure than success. And so if you're not well equipped to know how to manage fear, then you're not going to be very successful in baseball. So I thought that was a nice kind of parallel to go with.
Absolutely. JD, anything from you finally for Dan and or Brad?
No, the one question I had as we went along and you guys were talking about the process and being rejected, I'm just curious, as a writer, how does that work? When do you go to the publishers? I mean, how far along in the process are you when you start reaching out to publishers?
Well, I mean, it really depends on the book. I for Big Hair and Plastic Grass, it was really more, I'd done a lot of research, but hadn't, you know, I'd written a couple of sample chapters to send along with the proposal, but I wasn't going to do the full book until I had, you know, at least
some level of confidence.
Yeah, there was a deal involved. And then with Stars and Strikes, thankfully, Big Hair and Plastic Grass did well enough that, you know, that my publisher just said, what do you got next? And I knew I'd always, you know, while writing Big Hair and Plastic Grass, I knew that the 76 season really was crying out for a book. So that was thankfully pretty easy.
Yeah, for me, it's, you know, the biggest issue that I faced was the lack of what they call platform. So I think it's gotten harder and harder in recent years to break into book publishing and to get something published. And I had written a lot about a lot of articles and had been published a lot for shorter stuff, but more in science because I'm a biologist. And so, you know, when I first pitched the idea, I actually was advised by someone to take the road trip before trying to pitch the book, which I did. And then when I was pitching the book to editors, I didn't have the whole thing written. I had just, you know, I knew the story
framework.
And the reason why, I mean, what I was told in all those rejections most commonly was, oh, it's a great idea and it's great writing, but, you know, you don't have a giant following on Instagram or Twitter. And which was really demoralizing and frustrating, because you're basically being told, like, well, there's nothing you know, you're not a celebrity, so we're not going to publish your book.
Yeah, I mean, I Big Hair and Plastic Grass was being pitched before social media was as big a thing, but I definitely got the, like, well, you know, you're not Bob Costas, who's going to care what you have to say about baseball.
Right. And that's the other thing is that, you know, I was talking earlier about how I'm a character in the book. That was another thing that people were like, no, no one wants, you know, no one cares about you, or, you know, why should we read about Brad Baluchin? And so, I knew that the structure and the style I was going for was sort of really ambitious and kind of unorthodox for a baseball book. But I just needed someone to take that chance. And, you know, my thought was always, you know, how do you ever discover new voices if you never take a risk on somebody? Sure. So I'm grateful that ultimately I was able to get it done with University of Nebraska.
I got to tell you both, I think your books would not have resonated with me as much had they been written from more of an insider's perspective. To me, you know, whatever the percentage is, Brad, whether it's, you know, 60% of it or whatever, the enjoyment I got out of your book was the unorthodox methods you had to use to get to certain players. Look, I know someone who knows Carlton Fisk really well. And if you had emailed me, if we knew each other and you said, hey, I'm trying to get to Carlton Fisk, I'm not guaranteeing you that I could have gotten you in there.
Right.
But I could have talked to one of his best friends on the planet who could have very easily said, just do this. But right. That's not the point. Right?
Right. That's a good, yeah. Well said. Yeah.
And Dan, you know, I think that the 30,000 foot view of a decade like the 70s is hugely important because you tie in, as we said at the beginning of this interview, all the other things that were happening in the country. And to just talk baseball and nothing else, you know, the hairstyles in particular, artificial turf, the all-purpose stadiums. I mean, all of that stuff is you know, the inner cities, Detroit, New York, which is a very different era in New York City history in the 70s. I think you paint that picture incredibly well, and it would have been difficult if it were just from a baseball perspective.
Yeah, I mean, or even from a perspective of, you know, when Big Hair and Plastic Grass came out, that was sort of like right around the time of the rise in sabermetric analysis, you know, which is all very cool, but it's, you know, it's not my bag, baby. And as I say in the introduction to the book, you know, if you're looking for like extensive number crunching about, you know, on base percentages and WAR and all of that, this is not your book. But if you want in-depth analysis of Raleigh Finkers' mustache and Oscar Gamble's afro, then you're in the right place.
Exactly. Well, I commend both of you. The two books in particular we've talked about, I did the Audible version and you both read the books, which I think is really cool to put your own voice in the narrative. And, last thing, we're just going to let you guys tell us where to find you and any projects coming up in the future. Brad, you go first.
Sure. If you just go to waxpackbook.com, you can get all the links to where to get the book. It's pretty much available, you know, wherever books are sold. I'm also on Twitter at waxpackbook. And no projects immediately. I mean, I think I'm enjoying the process of promoting Waxpack, but also, you know, the kind of reporting and writing that I do, you couldn't even do right now with the pandemic. I mean, it's, you know, just out of the question. So I'm just kind of enjoying the ride right now and then see you down the line.
Dan?
Well, I'm at bighairplasticgrass.com. You can also find me on Facebook. There's a Big Hair and Plastic Grass page, and on Twitter at Big Hair Plas Grass. But I'm currently working on, and I should say my books, Big Hair Plastic Grass and Stars and Strikes, are both available from all areas you can find books, as well as Big Hair and Plastic Grass is in a audiobook format, as Len, you mentioned. But I am currently working on a book, which will be out next spring via Triumph Books, with Ron Bloomberg, who was the first designated hitter and member of the Yankees for most of his playing career. And it's called The Captain and Me, On and Off the Field with Thurman Munson. It's a memoir of their friendship, which was very much an odd couple kind of friendship, and it's filled with hilarious and very insightful stories about that era of baseball. So as we say, it's very much in my wheelhouse.
Cannot wait to read that. Dan Epstein, Brad Baloukchian, thank you so much for the time, guys. We really appreciate it. It was great.
Oh, thanks for having us, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, fellas.
Great stuff from Dan and Brad, and I would imagine we will end up selling some books here. And, you know, with baseball on the horizon, but not quite here, I would think the baseball book sales are going pretty well in general, JD.
Yeah, I would think people are kind of hungry to stay in touch with our game. And I think both those guys have done well with their books so far, and hopefully they'll continue to sell. But I couldn't help but, as we were talking to them, images were popping into my mind, right? Whether it was the 70s, and I could see those games between the Yankees and the Dodgers in the World Series. I could see Linda Ronstadt in center field singing the anthem at Dodger Stadium. And with Brad's book, you know, he mentions Don Carmen, and I can, you know, picture Don pitching for the Phillies. And I love the fact that his fandom wasn't based on star players, but he loved Don Carmen, and he loves kind of the underdog type player.
And I'm really looking forward to the book, the Ron Bloomberg, Thurman Munson book Dan hopes to have out next year.
Yeah, he seems to have a real good feel, obviously, for that era. And as he said in our conversation with him, he wants to stay in his lane. He's not gonna dabble in the 80s or anything else. He's gonna stay in the 70s because it's his bag.
Well, we went a little long with those guys, so save your admission for next week. We want to wish everybody a great 4th of July weekend. We want to thank Max Berman, Joe Rios, Matt Remito, Daniel Green, Big Jim Obojkowicz, Shane McGuire, and Adam Sobel. For Jim Deshaies, I'm Len Casper. Subscribe, rate, review, and share this podcast with your friends. We will talk to you next week on Open Concessions, presented by Toyota.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with 3 rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.